It says, it describes co-conspirator number one as a former president of the United States who spread false claims of election fraud following the 2020 election. And then it also goes on to say that this person...
And I'm narrowing it down. Give me some more.
You need to funnel it down a little bit more. It also says this person ran with Vice President Pence. So
I still might need to use a lifeline. Right. Call a friend.
Call a friend.
We will never give up. We will never concede. It doesn't happen.
Exactly what it was, and you get indicted over that?
I object to you getting what you do.
Welcome to the Trump Trials Sidebar from the Washington Post, where we focus on the legal cases and trials of former President Donald Trump. Today is one of those days when the bar for historic and unprecedented is raised again, because the Supreme Court is considering Trump's argument that he should be immune from prosecution for actions he took while president. And simultaneously, a jury is hearing testimony in Trump's criminal case in New York City. I'm Libby Casey, and I'm with my colleagues James Homan, Rhonda Colvin, and Devlin Barrett. You can send us your questions, comments, or observations to this email address, sidebar@washpost.com. Let's start in New York, where Devlin has been recently. The criminal trial where Trump faces 34 counts of falsifying business records. And of course, this is all swirling around allegations that money was paid to an adult film actress before the 2016 election to keep her quiet about an alleged affair with Donald Trump. What is the story that David Pecker is telling and the jurors are listening to?
David Pecker has been describing the world of tabloid celebrity gossip, how, you know, sort of the sausage is made inside the gossip factory, that is the National Enquirer and other publications. And that's important for this trial because so much of what allegedly happens that the prosecutors say is a crime grows out of the very specific and frankly odd relationship that David Pecker has and had with Trump when he was a candidate for president.
They were friends. They are friends.
They were and are. He smiles at Trump regularly on the witness stand. He's a pretty cheerful witness for a government witness. And I think that relationship is, you know, important to understand. And Pecker also serves another purpose for the prosecutors, which is he ends up acting as a kind of tour guide for the jury to understand this world. As important as he is in terms of providing evidence against Trump, he's at least as important to just explain to the jury how this world works.
Mm. And the world we're talking about is tabloid journalism. I hesitate to even use the word journalism, frankly, Rhonda. Tabloids catch and kill stories. Can you explain this world of catch and kill? And I mean, it's clearly not something we do in journalism, so talk to us about what's standing out from you.
Yeah, I love what Devlin just said about how Pecker is there to sort of introduce the world to this sort of underground way of trying to get stories, or as you said, they call it checkbook journalism. It's not journalism. It's not what we consider journalism, paying for stories or paying to suppress stories. So what the prosecution is doing is trying to show that David Pecker was a part of this scheme with Michael Cohen and with under Trump's awareness that he would sort of intercept stories that were negative about Trump during the 2015 and 2016 campaign. And that really is the core of this whole case, really, is to have someone like David Pecker take everybody into this world, tell people what the agreement was about, how it came to be. It is really interesting, though, as Devlin said, that they're friends. And I'm glad that you pointed out that his demeanor, that he's smiling. I heard that he said hello to Trump or the Trump table as he walked by on the first day. From what I've read, they go way back. I believe Pecker wanted to pitch Trump back in the 90s, a magazine idea called Trump Life.
Trump Style.
Trump Style.
That magazine did happen.
It was
a fantastic bit of testimony, because they just describe, like, well, you have all these people in hotels and casinos. You can just give the magazines to those people. Okay. I'm sure they were happy to have it.
Yes, I don't think it's still on newsstands, but it did do a few copies.
But I always read it was like, well, I'm eating a Trump steak and drinking Trump vodka.
Hey, you know, that's the weekend. But it is interesting to see this former friend or, you know, current friend of Trump tell all and to see that interaction, too. And Pecker, they go way back. Pecker has looked up to Trump, I believe, sort of wanted to model his business life after Trump. So it is interesting that he is the first witness. He's giving sort of this tell-all, play-by-play of what happened and how this type of scheme works.
So, James, why start with him, right? Why is the prosecution starting with Pecker? As Devlin said, he can be this guide. He can be like our Virgil taking us through, the tour. But why is he opening?
So his testimony on Thursday morning tied Trump directly to the conduct in question. Pecker testified that he personally discussed with Donald Trump that they were doing this, and he testified that he understood it. While they are friends, we're friends, he understood this to be helpful to the Trump campaign. He understood this to be a Trump campaign effort, and that he says he was desperate to get reimbursed by Michael Cohen, who was acting as Trump's fixer and lawyer, and was calling Michael Cohen all the time saying, hey, I want the check. Michael Cohen, who in many ways is the star witness here because he was the go-between, has so many credibility issues, which we'll talk about as he ends up coming on the stand. And so I think starting with this guy, it creates a nexus between Trump and the alleged crime. It's someone who's going to be more likable to a jury. The other thing that was striking is during his testimony on Thursday, he talked about how he had done the same thing for Arnold Schwarzenegger in 2002 and 2003, when Arnold Schwarzenegger, then a former actor, was running for governor. These women were coming forward and he was catching and killing their stories. Pecker was the National Enquirer. Mm-hmm. Eventually, one of the women who sold her story just went to the LA Times when the National Enquirer didn't run anything. The point of it all is that this is sort of it's showing the jury that this is a practice, that there is an infrastructure for this kind of checkbook journalism. I do think it is foundational, and I think the Pecker testimony, understandably because it's the government who's put him up first, has helped strengthen their case. And we'll see what happens when the defense gets a crack at him.
Yeah, you've pointed out, Devlin, that will be essential.
Right. I think one of the things that you got to remember about trials is each day is important, but each day is only that day. Trials are a little bit like a roller coaster. People have good days, people have bad days, there's ups and downs. Right now, Pecker is providing everything the prosecution wants him to provide. But I think whenever you have a friend of the defendant on the witness stand, the most important time isn't necessarily when the government is questioning him. It's really when the defendant's lawyers are questioning him. And the best example I can use of that is, if you remember the baseball pitcher Roger Clemens, mm-hmm. went on trial for allegedly lying to Congress about using steroids. The star witness against Roger Clemens was his former teammate, Andy Pettit, also a very, very, very good baseball player. Andy Pettit got on the stand, and in his direct, under questioning from prosecutors, he said, Roger Clemens admitted to me that he did it. He explained to me how he did it. And it was very straightforward, and it was devastating testimony against Clemens. But then he was cross-examined by Clemens' lawyer, and within the first 3 minutes, Andy Pettit said, no, I'm really not sure if I remember it correctly. I could have misunderstood what he meant. I really don't know. No idea. And just like that, in that short moment, that prosecution case completely died. I don't know that, I'm not saying that Pecker may have a similar life or death effect on this case. I kind of doubt he will. But I think whenever you think about the meaning of Pecker in this case, you really need to wait until you see the cross to know how important he ultimately is. Because I suspect, given the body language, he still very much likes Donald Trump. And I suspect when Donald Trump's lawyers get a chance to question David Pecker, that's going to be a very friendly conversation, and that is probably going to be a very helpful conversation to Trump.
Just this morning, Trump made a campaign stop. He has kind of a limited range of campaign stop opportunities because he's stuck in this courtroom most days of the week. He was in New York City at a construction site. A reporter asked him about Pecker, and he had good things to say, essentially that the testimony was very good. So there's a question of whether Trump should be talking at all about the witnesses, Devlin. But... not adversarial in his reaction this morning.
Right, and I think that's a good indicator of where this is likely going.
What is it that Pecker could say that would be, in that great baseball analogy that you used, what is it that Pecker could reveal, or what tone could he have? How could he be helpful to Trump on cross?
So he's not allowed to talk about, I don't believe the judge is going to let Pecker talk about what legal advice they got in the course of this thing. But there are ways for the defense lawyers to sort of hint at that and get close to the line and maybe even cross it, get an objection, and have the judge strike it from the record, but like the jury all heard it. So one thing that Pecker could do that would be greatly helpful to Trump's cause is convey in some way to the jury, look, yes, we did these things. You may consider them to be bad things, but we were told by multiple people as we were doing them that they were not illegal things. These were not crimes. And so if someone is telling you now, if the prosecutor or anyone else is telling you now that, you know, I am evidence of Trump's criminal behavior, I, the witness, do not believe that. And I, the witness, you know, mm-hmm. went through a whole procedure to make sure that I wasn't touching anything like that. And that could be very helpful to Trump. I also think there's a way in which he could talk about Trump's lack of knowledge and lack of conversation. I suspect that Trump's lawyers will really bear down on, okay, but Mr. Pecker, what did you actually discuss about the mechanics of this with Trump? How precise were you in these conversations? And, you know, I think there are times, like certainly in the Cohen conversations, we know there are times when the evidence just points to Trump not knowing the details. And here, the reason that matters is, in this case, the details are the crime. It's not that Trump says, pay her.
So David Pecker is describing this effort to really make Trump look good on the pages of the National Enquirer, also kill or suppress stories that would have made him look bad. This is on the eve of the election. He even testifies that they would be willing to let some stories go and run after the election, right, which shows a concern about timing. But Devlin, is there a danger in the jury just thinking, oh, this is normal? Like, this is how business is done. This is tabloid life. Where's the actual crime?
Sure, and that's certainly the defense lawyer's argument, both in the openings and in the sidebars, which the jury doesn't get to see. The defense has taken the position, like, you're just polluting the jurors' minds with a bunch of bad conduct by our client that is not actually a crime. And you can tell that they are that's going to be a note that they're going to hit again and again and again with this jury.
Like, is there a danger in Pecker just normalizing this?
Sure.
Sort of seedy behavior and transactional, like, famous people activity. Do you
but
guys know what I mean?
This is politics.
Right, right. Yeah. This is how politics operates.
You're trying to criminalize politics. Everyone right. does it.
So how is the prosecution going to say, here's the criminal act?
So it takes a lot to unpack the prosecution theory of this case. This is not a simple theory or you know, one-sentence theory of this case.
And did you get a sense of it in opening statements?
You did. But in, almost more importantly, they finally sort of picked a lane in terms of what the prosecution theory of how this all amounts to felony crimes. Mm-hmm. They did that in a sidebar after the openings because they're going to keep arguing about evidence, what evidence can come in. There was this came up during an argument over evidence related to Steve Bannon, and the defense's position was Steve Bannon has nothing to do with this case. You're just inserting a guy that some people don't like for saying things that those same people don't like, and that's not relevant to what we're doing here. It's pretty clear that's going to be a continual point of disagreement between the prosecution and the defense here. I think what I'm really sort of like trying to spot is to what degree does the prosecution theory, as complex as it is, create opportunities for the defense to say, you know, they've built a, you know, Rube Goldberg device here. Like, this is absurd. Lawyers don't get to argue the law to the jury, so they are probably going to be significantly restricted in that. But what they can do is they can argue common sense. And I think you already see in openings and other things, you're already seeing the defense lay the groundwork for your common sense tells you, in theory, this isn't a crime. We shouldn't be here.
Let's talk about the gag order on Trump, Rhonda, and how he's been pushing the boundaries of that and where we're at in terms of penalties and repercussions.
Well, we don't quite know where we're at just yet. The judge right now has not made a decision yet on if Trump has violated the gag order. The prosecution has been arguing that he has, that the Truth Social post and other things that he has said about the witnesses are part of that violation. So we'll see where this goes. I think one thing that was so interesting to me this week is that line that the judge said where he told one of the Trump lawyers that you're losing all credibility here because Trump's lawyers are not being direct in their arguments for why Trump should not be held liable for violating this gag order. So it seems as if the judge and the Trump lawyers are constantly tangling and there's some tension there, but we'll see where this goes. But, you know, the prosecution, I mean, I'm no lawyer, but just from what I have read from your great reporting and everyone else's great reporting is that, you know, there is documentation, you know, Truth Social post that Trump is talking about witnesses, which is exactly what he is not supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. James. This is a complicated issue. There's never been a trial quite like this. Obviously, it's the first time a former president is on trial. So much about these proceedings makes Trump seem small. For the first time in a very long time, he's not in control of the proceedings. At one point the other day, the judge also said, please sit down, sir, when he stood up to go. And the Truth Social posts and the talking to reporters in the hallway, this is a way of Trump establishing control and trying to make himself look bigger. And it is awkward when you also normally don't have witnesses attacking the defendant publicly, but you have Michael Cohen on his podcast.
And he has now pledged he's going to stop.
Right.
So he just said, Michael Cohen said he's going to stop and stay quiet until after he testifies.
Right.
What a blessing for the prosecutors.
but it's really hard.
It's done so much damage.
It's unbelievable to me. I've never seen
explain that to us, Devlin, because it's sort of like, how can you expect Trump to stay quiet? If how can you expect Trump to not attack Cohen if Cohen's attacking him?
Trump's best counterargument to his problem of repeated alleged violations of the gag order is Michael Cohen and what Cohen's doing. And it is amazing to behold the degree to which the Manhattan DA's office seems to have virtually no control over their star witness in this case. The I think it's the first or the second day of trial, Cohen was angrily posting on social media about him, calling him, you know, using profanities.
Trump? Yes. Yeah.
Using profanities to refer to Trump, vowing to, like, you know, just stuff I've never seen a star witness.
I don't think I've ever seen you so tongue-tied, Devlin.
It was like, you just don't see it. It's,
yeah. I can point to a comparison or an analogous case in almost any fact you throw at me. There is no analogy to what Cohen has done in his public statements as the star witness waiting for a trial. I'm always reminded of, because remember, all these issues were investigated previously by the feds, and there's a lot of Fed-local rivalry, and that's fine, and everyone should get their crack at whatever they want to get their crack at. But I'll never forget years ago talking to a Fed about Michael Cohen, and they said, look, the bottom line is there will never be, ever be a prosecution that uses a government prosecution that uses Michael Cohen as a witness. And obviously that person was talking about the federal side, but everything you're seeing now is the reason why that person said that. And I am fascinated to see how the district attorney's office tries to make him believable. It's going to be very difficult.
We'll watch and see what are the repercussions for Trump and if the judge finds he's violated the gag order and what the penalties could be. $1,000, it could go up and go up. But really, what kind of a penalty is that for Donald Trump? Right.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, it feels like I guess one potential option would be incarceration, a brief period of.
Here's what's so crazy about the contempt thing and the gag order thing, and which is, I think, a risk for all the judges in all the Trump cases. He knows on some level that he can dare them to jail him.
Exactly.
And he has literally done that. He has dared them to jail him. Mm-hmm. And so the problem
And that would be good for him politically in some ways, right?
I think he would much rather be having a pitched battle over what he is allowed to say and what he's not allowed mm-hmm. to say than what he did or didn't
mm-hmm.
do.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is a much better fight for him to have. And I also think, from the court's point of view, not referring specifically to Judge Mershon, but like just in general posture of judges, I would be surprised if any judge in any jurisdiction really wants to put him in, as they say. I think, to be honest, back to the Jean Carroll trial for defamation that happened months ago, I think that judge might have put him in. Judge Kaplan has a view of contempt that is different than any other judge I've ever covered. But Kaplan is unique. I do not think these other judges have any appetite for doing that. But the problem is, once you start down this road, once you start issuing, you know, threats and warnings, you either back that up or you back off.
I have learned that as a parent over and over again, Devlin. It's true.
You know, I heard a judge say that if this was happening in her courtroom, she would actually take Trump out, put him in a holding room where he's able to watch on a monitor, you know, have Secret Service with him, maybe somebody from his legal defense with him, and watch it instead of being there in this sort of theater. I wonder if Marchand would consider that, instead of the incarceration or the gag order
it's
fees.
It's always an option, except for that approach is normally reserved for people who speak in court. Trump is very, I think, calculated in that he will do it in the court, in the hallway outside court, and he will certainly do it on social media, and he will certainly do it sometimes in front of the cameras when he's, you know, doing a campaign appearance. But Trump's behavior in court has been very restrained in that sense. He's not contemptuous in court. And so I think a judge, that approach is harder to do when that's not really the problem you're dealing with. I think he could do it, but that's not really the way the law is generally applied. And I think so much of what these Trump cases are about is people want to follow the rule of law. People want to show that no one is above the law. But people are also, I think, with some justification, very worried that they are seen as bending the law to get a result for this particular person. And I think that's one thing that Trump has working to his advantage, because Trump doesn't care about the norms. Trump thinks the norms are often just used by scared and less effective people to hamper the more effective people like himself. So I do think there's an power imbalance there in a weird way. As powerless as he often is in court, he does have other cards to play, and he plays them very loudly.
Devlin Barrett, thank you so much for hanging out with us. Everybody else, stay with us. We will talk in a moment about all the seemingly random things that Donald Trump talks about outside of the courtroom, and we'll dig into our word of the week, which takes us all the way to Arizona. Stay with us. This is the Trump trial's sidebar from the Washington Post. So as jurors in New York listen to accusations against Donald Trump, and as other teams of prosecutors prepare to try multiple cases against him, let's zoom out to this question of whether an ex-president can be charged and prosecuted with acts taken while in office. We're talking about presidential immunity, and that's what's before the Supreme Court this week, Rhonda. When you heard oral arguments today, did you get an indication that the justices are prepared to offer presidents a big, warm blanket of immunity?
I don't think we have a strong indication that they would give him blanket immunity. They did seem very skeptical at first, specifically when they were questioning Trump's lawyer in this case to see if a president can enjoy this blanket immunity from criminal charges. From the liberal justices, we heard that they are very concerned about how this is a history-making precedent if they were to give blanket immunity. They are concerned that that would create issues in the Oval Office from here on out, where you might have presidents take part of criminal activity and have immunity. Then we heard from conservative justices. They are also concerned about weighing in and what this could do for history. But their main concern surrounds the idea that if a president can't be shielded from immunity, then that means that anyone might be able to sue them, and they're not going to be able to focus on their job. So we don't have exactly a clear picture. Of course, we know that their decision may come in mid-June or in the month of June, but we don't yet know which way they may go. One thing that could happen is they could bounce this back down to the lower courts and have them provide more clarification on the issue and not exactly weigh in. But what that does mean is that would further delay the Jack Smith case. That's, of course, is the case surrounding Trump's conduct around January 6th.
I mean, that's the crux of this, James, right? Whether or not he can go on trial in this January 6th case. But every delay is significant because it gets Trump closer to the finish line of the election without going to trial on that case.
And there are definitely 5 votes on the Supreme Court to not go as far as Trump wants, which is blanket immunity, but that some official acts, and the big debate is, what are those official acts? Where do you draw the line? are protected from criminal immunity. And Chief Justice John Roberts sounded very overtly skeptical of the 3-0 ruling by the D.C. Circuit, a court on which he used to serve. And then Kavanaugh, Gorsuch, Alito, and Thomas will definitely join him. So I imagine Roberts creates some kind of test for weighing public versus private, but doesn't actually say we're going to go through each of the alleged offenses in the Trump indictments by Jack Smith. And then the question is, how specific is the test? How much gray area? How much wiggle room? But it, you're absolutely right. It causes delay. It means that the Trump folks are going to fight over every single act that's alleged. And then they'll have the right, depending on how the decision is written, once it's remanded to the district court, to appeal it back to the D.C. Circuit and potentially back to the Supreme Court.
I mean, I hear delay.
It feels, based on my hearing of the oral arguments today, like there's no longer any realistic chance that the January 6th actual trial. I think the case could end up being active and there could be developments, but it feels like there's no chance there's going to be a trial before the 2024 election.
I mean, that's remarkable.
And if Trump wins, he can drop the charges against him. If Trump loses, that means a trial after the election. It is remarkable. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, we're talking about events that were almost 4 years ago, 3.5 years ago.
An entire election cycle ago. Mm-hmm.
And what I've heard from, you know, members of the January 6th Select Committee who investigated this case and sent a lot of their work over to the DOJ, they think, you know, yes, if Biden wins, this will keep going. But the fact that some voters won't have all of the information to work with before they make decisions, specifically the voters who are in the middle and maybe on the fence about Biden or Trump, the fact that they may not be able to see a lot of the evidence that committee knows exists and would come out in this trial, you know, they feel very strongly about the fact that this is pretty bad that the Supreme Court delayed this to the point where you may not have this come to all of these details come to light for voters to be educated on.
All right, well, we'll watch to see when the court weighs in on that. And now for our word of the week, although, again, it's actually a phrase of the week, so maybe we should rename this segment.
Words
of the week. Thank you, James. Unindicted co-conspirator. So there are 2 more cases involving Donald Trump and the 2020 election, one in Arizona, one in Michigan, where attorneys, aides, local Republicans have been indicted on charges related to allegedly trying to subvert that election outcome. In Arizona, at the center of it all, Rhonda, is someone called Unindicted Co-Conspirator 1. Who could this be?
I think all roads lead to Donald Trump. The indictment, this is from the indictment, it describes co-conspirator number 1 as a former president of the United States who spread false claims of election fraud following the 2020 election. And then it also goes on to say that this person...
I'm narrowing it down. Give me some more.
You need to funnel it down a little bit more. It also says this person ran with Vice President Pence. So
I still might need to use a lifeline. Right. Call a friend.
So we are thinking that this is the former president, Donald Trump, as an unindicted co-conspirator. And what that means is the grand jury did find that this person was aware of that scheme, the fake electors scheme, but is not being charged. So that, in a nutshell, is what's going on there in Arizona.
Yeah, and the unindicted co-conspirator was a term that came up during the Trump presidency in the Michael Cohen situation we were talking about, when Michael Cohen pleaded guilty to federal campaign finance charges. Trump was also unindicted co-conspirator number 1. It was pretty clear who they were talking about. It is interesting that Arizona opted not to charge Trump himself, probably because they see that he's facing these charges in Georgia for something very similar. But the people they are going after are the campaign lawyers and those fake electors themselves. But certainly there will be evidence that comes up during that trial in Arizona that could directly implicate Trump in that conspiracy.
Mm-hmm. Donald Trump, whether he likes it or not, is sitting in the courtroom in New York, apparently a very chilly courtroom, as we'll talk about in a minute. Now, he may be under a gag order, but Trump does speak to the cameras and reporters outside of the courtroom. J.M. Rieger joins us now to talk about what is on Donald Trump's mind, what is coming out of his mouth, and what he chooses to focus on when he has the ear of the media. J.M., is Trump talking about the trial or what?
All of the above in some ways, right? We've watched every single appearance that he's made over the first 10 days of this trial. He's spoken to the cameras outside that courtroom every single day so far, sometimes multiple times a day. And he's sort of riffed on sometimes stream of consciousness, sort of the things that we've come to expect from Trump. Sometimes he's talked specifically about the trial. The prosecution has said that some of the things that he is saying out there, they called it, quote, his press conferences, whatever they are in violation of that gag order. And that's sort of an apt description in some ways for this, because sometimes he'll come up and he'll talk for all of 10 or 20 seconds about, we're about to go in, we're going to talk about this, this trial's a sham, sort of the usual rhetoric. Sometimes he'll sit there for minutes on end. The other day last week, he had a stack of articles, and he spent over 3 minutes reading article headlines to the reporters who were gathered there. The point being that he was trying to say that these articles are saying this is not a strong case, this is a sham trial. But it's a lot of the usual talking points sprinkled in with a lot of seemingly random points, as well as some falsehoods.
Let's listen to some of this.
I have a lot to say to you, and I'm not allowed to say it. Sitting up as straight as I can all day long. I'm only telling the truth. They're not telling the truth. In that freezing room, freezing. Everybody was freezing in there.
It's freezing, by the way.
I'm going to get Trump. It's an assault on America. And that's why I'm very proud to be here.
So you can hear there, I mean, he is sort of all over the map. He's upset about the temperature of the courtroom. He's upset about the coverage. He's upset about, he came out after the first day and talked about how the judge wouldn't let him go to his son's high school graduation, which turned out not to be true. When the transcript came out the next day, that's not what the judge said. And it's really a reflection on Trump being stuck. Trump has to be there. And he's not, he can go out and campaign, but his schedule on a daily basis is limited. So you can kind of see him on a day-to-day basis sort of trying to figure out what he's going to talk about, how he is going to try and push the case against Joe Biden in this 2024 campaign.
Yeah, it's like he goes out and blows off steam, but you know, the jury obviously doesn't hear this. They're not supposed to hear this, right, James?
Well, it's funny, but, you know, Trump is a master of the media. He knows all press is good press. He came of age in the New York tabloid era, but he's also sitting there for hours on end in this courtroom, a lot of boring legal stuff, and you know he's thinking about sort of what's a good line, what's a good soundbite. He thinks in terms of soundbites. As president, he used to think in terms of, did we win the day? Did we win the news cycle? And a lot of his aides said, you really need to think bigger than winning one news cycle in one day. You've got to think about not a week or a month, but the whole presidency. And I think it is a challenge for the prosecution, because you're right, the jurors aren't supposed to see this. They all say all but one of the jurors say they're consuming media. I'm sure it's getting picked up. But the prosecution, at this point, you know, now that the jury selection has passed, they actually are making arguments in the courtroom. But for the first couple days, the stories were Trump's version of events, mm-hmm. Trump's line, without a pushback from the prosecution, because they're not allowed to. And that was so reminiscent of 2016, when Trump would say outrageous things and no one knew what to say. And so they decided not to respond at all. And that ended up being a problem. So this, it just feels like Trump is sort of has, to Devlin's point earlier, Trump knows how to play this outside game. He's not as good at the inside game. He's not as good in the courtroom, but this is his jam.
As unhinged, and that's a great point to talk about his background as a television producer mm-hmm. with The Apprentice. Yeah. During his time in the White House, he would talk about people, members of Congress being out of central casting. Mm-hmm. He's very much about the optics, so he knows what he's doing. But you talked about the prosecution and how this might be difficult for them to kind of, you know, get their candidate in check or get their defendant in check. Not the prosecution, the defense. But I'm also thinking of his campaign, because I can't imagine they would advise him to do this every day when he's going in, when he's coming out. And I'll also point out that this is not a real press conference area. This is a hallway. You see, you know, sort of the barricades that are built. He's basically shouting to the cameras that are set up there.
Yeah, you can hear that audio is a little hard to catch.
He's not mic'd. Mm-hmm. So this is sort of him on the fly although it is very planned, when he goes in and when he leaves every day, you have to wonder about his campaign and what they're going to do with this, because there are Americans who, you know, do support Trump and think that this is great, that this is about all the grievances, and they've, you know, signed on to support him. But there are folks in the middle who might tire of seeing him talk about how cold it is, talk about how everybody's after him, talk about these consistent themes every time we see him. So I'm just wondering, what is his campaign going to do about this? And would he even listen? I mean, that's the real question.
I mean, that's such a great point, because in some ways, these, whatever we're calling them, press conferences, gaggles, are sort of mini rallies, because much like his rallies, where sometimes he will go off script or on tangents for minutes and minutes at a time, the same exact thing is happening here. And it's simultaneously valuable because we are hearing from a defendant, the first ever president on a criminal trial, and we're hearing from him on a daily basis, also the front runner for the Republican nomination. But simultaneously, if he is spewing things that are not true, or just sort of random observations, if you will, of the day, that there's sort of that balancing act, right, of how much of this is actually valuable for folks to know about. And that's why we've been watching him every single day and tracking what he's saying.
J.M. Rieger, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've got a question that's come into our reader mailbag, and you can write to us. That's sidebar@washpost.com. A reader asks, we know Donald Trump could get in trouble if he violates his gag order, but what about Trump's lawyers? The judge has already said Trump's lawyer is losing all credibility. So is the lawyer in a tough spot representing this client? Could he get in trouble with the Bar Association? James?
I mean, we were just talking about Arizona, and a bunch of Trump's lawyers from 2020 are facing criminal charges for their conduct. There's higher expectations for members of the bar who have taken an oath, have to follow legal rules. A lot of Trump's attorneys have been facing disciplinary proceedings in different states related to their conduct. So absolutely. But the bar is pretty high to show misconduct, which we definitely saw some of in 2020. Less so here. I was struck, you know, Todd Blanche is doing what Trump wants him to do in New York, even if it pisses off the judge. In the Supreme Court case today, John Sauer also opened by, basically, it sounded like he was reading a Trump Truth Social post. The first 60 seconds of his speech to the justices was very kind of unjudicial, and it really sounded like Donald Trump talking. And I do think that is, if you're the lawyer, that's who's paying the bills. That's part of your constituency. And it's always a challenge of working for Donald Trump because he goes through a lot of lawyers. A lot of people, I think, in the legal profession want to control their clients, want to tell their clients what to say and not say. And Trump is a client who cannot be controlled.
To James's point, I've been thinking about this a lot because we have covered other Trump legal issues, and we've seen his lawyers, you know, leave in the middle of the case and just say, true, I'm done. And they have, some of the ones who have spoken to media have suggested he is a tough client. So you have to wonder, are they also thinking about their profession when they decide to represent him? And then also think about his world of lawyers. Okay, Michael Cohen, Rudy Giuliani, these are people who have faced charges, or in Cohen's world, he has actually gone to prison. Giuliani, you know, he's got a lot of charges too that he's facing. So
Jenna Ellis, Kenneth Cheeseborough,
right,
I mean,
it is,
you really
a
can
long,
go through a
long list of legal folks who have been in Trump's orbit and have had to face charges themselves. So it's a great reader mailbag question to think about.
Well, that's all we have time for today. So once again, sidebar@washpost.com. Send us your questions. And if you're looking for a quick way to catch up on the most important stories of the day from the Washington Post, not just in the world of Trump's trials, check out another Washington Post podcast, The 7, at washingtonpost.com/7. You can subscribe to our show at youtube.com/Washington Post or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Libby Casey. You're with Rhonda Colvin, James Homan. We'll see you next week.